3 days later, I found myself standing on top of a termite hill, staring at another termite hill through binoculars. I knew that what I was standing on was a termite hill, but was disappointed that the thing I was staring at was not a northern white rhinoceros, since we had been walking determinedly towards it for upwards of an hour in the blazing midday sun in the middle of what can only be described as Africa. Also, we had run out of water. I could scarcely believe, having been brought up on a rich diet of H. Rider Haggard, Noel Coward, and the Eagle, that the first thing I would do on encountering the actual real savannah plains of Africa was to march straight out into them in the midday sun and run out of water. Though I wouldn't admit it, of course, having been brought up on a rich diet of H. Rider Haggard, etc., I was actually a bit frightened. The point about not running out of water in the middle of the savannah is that you do actually need the stuff. Your body regularly mentions to you that you need it, and after a while becomes quite strident on the subject. Furthermore, we were miles from anywhere, and though there were a number of theories flying around about where we'd left the Land Rover, none of them so far had stood up to rigorous testing. I don't know how worried Mark or Chris were at this point, because it was difficult to get them, particularly Chris, to say anything coherent. Chris is from Glasgow, and is an excellent specimen of one of the northern races, fair-haired and fair-skinned, and never happier than carrying a DAT recorder and a microphone wrapped up in something that looks like a large dead rabbit across the Scottish moors with the wind and rain lashing at his gritted teeth. He is not a natural for the savannah. He was walking by now in smaller and smaller circles and discussing less and less sensible things while glowing like a traffic light. Mark was getting red and sullen. The two women with us thought we were complete wimps. They were Kez Hillman-Smith, a rhino expert, and Annette Lanchow, a chimpanzee expert. Kez Hillman-Smith took over from me on the termite hill and scanned the horizon. Kez is in fact one of the world's leading experts on northern white rhinos, but she was not a world authority on where, in a national park the size of Scotland, the 22 surviving white rhino were to be found at that precise moment. I may have got my facts wrong. I seem to have conflicting information on the size of Garamba National Park. One opinion is that it is only 5,000 square kilometres, in which case I would have to say that it was only the size of part of Scotland, but it was a big enough part for 22 rhinoceroses to be very effectively hidden in. Kez had been very sceptical about the termite hill from the outset, as it would befit a world expert on rhinoceroses to be, but since it was the only thing in the distant heat haze that looked even remotely like a rhino, and we had come all this way, she had suggested that we may as well go for it. Kez is a formidable woman, who looks as if she had just walked off the screen of a slightly naughty adventure movie. Lean, fit, strikingly beautiful, and usually dressed in old combat gear that's had a number of its buttons shot off. She decided it was time to be businesslike about the map, which is a fairly rough representation of a fairly rough landscape. She worked out once and for all where the Land Rover had to be, and worked it out with such ruthless determination that the Land Rover would hardly dare not to be there, and eventually, of course, after miles of trekking, it was exactly there, hiding behind a bush with a thermos of tea wedged behind the seat. Once we had revived ourselves with the sort of mug of tea which makes the desert bloom and angels sing, we rattled and rolled our way back to base, which was a small visitor's village of huts on the edge of Garamba National Park, separated from it by a small river. We were currently the only visitors to the park, which, as I say, is the size of part of Scotland. This is quite surprising because the park is one of Africa's richest. It is situated in northeast Zaire, on the border with the Sudan, and takes its name from the Garamba River, which meanders from east to west through the park. Its habitat is a combination of savanna, gallery forest, and papyrus marshes, and contains currently 53,000 buffalo, 5,000 elephants, 3,000 hippos, 175 Congo giraffes, 270 species of birds, 60-odd lion, and some giant eland, which are large spiral-horned antelopes. They know there are giant eland in the park because we saw one. The last time anybody saw one there was in the 1950s. We were rather pleased about that. The park is very scantily visited, partly, I imagine, because of the insane bureaucratic nightmares which assail any visitor to Zaire, but also because the park is 3 days overland journey from Bunia, the nearest airport, so only the most determined visitors actually make it. We were lucky. The senior management advisor on the Garamba Rehabilitation Project, Charles Mackey, came to pick us up from Bunia in an anti-poaching patrol Cessna 185. The runway on which we landed, just outside the boundaries of the park, was merely a flattened piece of grass along which we bounded and hopped before finally slewing to a halt. It was a dramatic change from the cold mistiness of the Virunga volcanoes. Grassland as far as the horizon in every direction, hot, dry air, a Land Rover bounding along dusty roads through the savannah, and elephants heaving themselves along in the hazy distance. That evening, we went to have a meal at the house which Kez shares with her husband, Fraser, a park conservation manager. It was a house they built themselves, out in the bush on the edge of the river. The house is a long, low, rambling structure, full of books, and largely open to the weather. When it rains, they lower tarpaulins over the spaces where the windows aren't. For the 2 years it took them to build the house, they lived in a tiny mud hut with a pet mongoose that used to dig up the floor looking for worms, a dog, two cats, and a baby. Because the house is so open, it's regularly full of animals. A young hippo, for instance, frequently comes to chew on the pot plants in their living room. It often spends the night asleep in their bedroom, with its head resting next to the second baby's cot. There are snakes and elephants in the garden, rats which eat all their soap, and termites gradually nibbling away at the support poles of the house. The only animals that really worry them are the crocodiles, which live in the river at the bottom of the garden. Their dog was eaten by one. It's a bit of a worry, Kez told us, but we just have to make our lives as comfortable as possible under the circumstances. If we lived in the city, we'd be just as concerned about the children getting run over by a bus or abducted as we are about them being attacked by a crocodile. After dinner, they said that if we wanted to stand a hope in hell of actually seeing any rhino, then it would help considerably if we could find out where they actually were. They suggested that we ask Charles to take us up in the Cessna the next day, and then perhaps we could go up by Land Rover again the day after that to see how close we could get to them. They contacted Charles over their battered old field radio and made the arrangements. Charles flies his plane the same way my mother drives her car around the country lanes in Dorset. If you didn't know she had done it invincibly every day of her life for years, you would be hiding in the footwell, gibbering with fear, instead of just smiling glassily and humming Abide With Me. Charles is a thin and slightly intense man, and also rather shy. Sometimes you think you must have done something which has slightly offended him, and then realize that the sudden silence is only because he can't think of anything to say next and has given up. In the plane, though, there is so much to see that he is very talkative, and also, of course, very hard to hear. He had to say it 3 times before I finally believed that I wasn't dreaming it. He said he just wanted to count the eggs in the nest of a saddle-billed stork at the top of the tree we were fast approaching. He banked sharply over the top of the tree and then appeared to put the handbrake on while he leant out of the window and counted the eggs. The cockpit was thick with the sound of Abide With Me as the plane seemed slowly to start tumbling sideways out of the sky. He seemed to miscount twice before he was happy with the final tally, whereupon he hauled his head back through the window, turned to ask if we were doing all right, and then turned back, refastened the window, and at last scooped the plane back up into the air moments before death. From the air, the savannah looks like ostrich skin stretched across the land. We passed a small group of elephants nodding and bowing their way across the plains. Charles shouted over his shoulder at us that they have a project in the Garamba National Park for training elephants and have achieved the first major success in this field since Hannibal. African elephants are intelligent, but notoriously difficult to train. And in the old Tarzan movies, they used to use Indian elephants and stick bigger ears on them. The ultimate aim of this project is to use elephants on anti-poaching patrols and also on tourist safaris. Once again, tourist revenue is seen as the one certain way of ensuring the future survival of the threatened wildlife of the area. We wheeled around in ever-increasing circles, looking out for anything resembling a rhinoceros. From up here, they would clearly be much easier to distinguish from termite hills, if only for the sheer speed with which they move. Suddenly, there was one. And there, as we passed a screen of trees, was another. There, in fact, were another two, a mother and daughter, quite close to us, moving rapidly across the plain like trotting boulders. Even seen from a couple of 100 feet in the air, the sense of massive weight on the move is extraordinarily impressive. As we crossed the steady path the mother and daughter were keeping and wheeled round back over them, descending as we did so, it felt as if we were participating in a problem of three-body physics, swinging round in the gravitational pull of the rhinos. We took another pass over them, lower and slower, directly following their path, coming as close to them as we could, and this time the sense was of taking part in military manoeuvres in which we were giving air cover to some monstrous cavalry hurtling across the plain. Shouting above the noise in the cockpit, we asked Charles if it didn't worry the rhino, having us flying so close to them. "Not half as much as it worries you," he said. "No, it doesn't bother them at all, really. A rhino isn't scared of anything very much, and is only really interested in what things smell like. We fly down low over them pretty regularly to get a good look at them, identify them, see what they're up to, check that they're healthy, and so on. We know them all pretty well, and we'd know if they were upset about anything." I was struck again by something that was becoming a truism on these travels, that seeing animals such as these in a zoo was absolutely no preparation for seeing them in the wild. Great beasts moving through seemingly limitless space, utterly the masters of their own world. Or almost the masters. The next rhino we found, a mile or so further on, was engaged in a standoff with a hyena. The hyena was circling warily round the rhino, while the rhino peered at it myopically over its lowered horns. A rhino's eyesight is not particularly acute, and if he wants to get a good look at something, it'll tend to look at it first with one eye and then with the other. Its eyes are on either side of its skull, and it can't see straight ahead. Charles pointed out as we flew over that this rhino had had problems with hyenas before. Half of its tail was missing. By now, I was beginning to feel seriously airsick, and we started to head back. The purpose of the trip was just to find out where the rhinos were, and out of a total wild population of 22 rhinos, we had seen altogether 8. Tomorrow, we would set out overland to see if we could get close to one on the ground level. One of the things that people who don't know anything about white rhinoceroses find most interesting about them is their colour. It isn't white. Not even remotely. It's a rather handsome dark grey, not even a sort of pale grey that might arguably pass as an off-white, just plain dark grey. People therefore assume that zoologists are either perverse or colourblind, but it's not that, it's that they're illiterate. White is a mistranslation of the Afrikaans word wyd, meaning wide, and it refers to the animal's mouth, which is wider than that of the black rhino. By one of those lucky chances, the white rhino is in fact a very slightly lighter shade of dark grey than the black rhino. If the white rhino had actually been darker than the black rhino, people would just get cross, which would be a pity since there are many better things to get cross about regarding the white rhino than its colour, such as what happens to its horns. There's a widespread myth about what people want rhino horns for. In fact, two myths. The first myth is that ground rhino horn is an aphrodisiac. This, I think it's safe to say, is just what it appears to be, superstition. It has little to do with any known medical fact, and probably a lot to do with the fact that a rhino's horn is a big, sticky-up, hard thing. The second myth is that anyone actually believes the first myth. It was probably the invention of a journalist, or best, a misunderstanding. It's easy to see where the idea came from when you consider the variety of things that the Chinese, for example, believe to be aphrodisiacs, which include the brain of a monkey, the tongue of a sparrow, the human placenta, the penis of a white horse, rabbit hair from old brushes, and the dried sexual parts of a male tiger soaked in a bottle of European brandy for 6 months. A big sticky-up hard thing like a rhinoceros horn would seem to be a natural for such a list, though it's perhaps harder to understand in this context why grinding the thing down would be such an attractive idea. The fact is that there is no actual evidence to suggest that the Chinese do believe rhino horn to be an aphrodisiac. The only people who do believe it are people who've read somewhere that other people believe it and are ready and willing to believe anything they hear that they like the sound of. There is no known trade in rhino horn for the purposes of aphrodisia. This, like most things, is no longer strictly true. It is now known that there are a couple of people in northern India who use it, but they only do it to annoy. Some horn is used in traditional medicine in the Far East, but a major part of the trade in rhino horn is caused by something much more absurd, and it's this. Fashion. Dagger handles made of rhinoceros horn are an extremely fashionable item of male jewellery in the Yemen. That's it. Costume jewellery. Let's see the effect of this fashion. Northern white rhinos were unknown to the Western world until their discovery in 1903. At the time, there were enormous numbers of them in 5 different countries: Chad, Central African Republic, Sudan, Uganda, and Zaire. But their discovery spelt disaster, because unfortunately for the northern white rhino, it has two horns, which makes it doubly attractive to poachers. The front one, the longest, averages 2 feet in length. The world record holder had an incredible horn 6 feet long, and sadly was worth some $5,000. By 1980, all but 1,000 had been killed by poachers. There were still no serious efforts to protect them, and 5 years later, the population reached an all-time low of just 13 animals, all living in Garamba National Park. The animal was on the verge of extinction. Until 1984, Garamba's 5,000 square kilometres were under the protection of a small number of staff. These staff were untrained, often unpaid, had no vehicles and no equipment. If a poacher wanted to kill a rhino, all he had to do was turn up. Even local Zairua occasionally killed the rhinos to fashion small pieces of horn into rings, which they believed would protect them against poison and harmful people. But most of the horn was taken by heavily armed Sudanese poachers. It was taken back to Sudan, and from there entered the illegal international marketplace. The situation in Garamba has improved dramatically since then, with the rehabilitation project which began in 1984. There is now a total of 246 trained staff, with 11 vehicles, a light aircraft, permanent guard posts throughout the park, and mobile patrols all in radio contact with one another. Two rhinos poached in May 1984, immediately after the rehabilitation work began, were the last to be killed in the park. The poacher was caught and imprisoned, but later allowed to escape. Attitudes have changed so much now that it is unlikely he would be allowed to escape again. Other species are still poached, but intensive protection over the past 5 years has at last begun to have an effect. In fact, there have been a number of rhino births, and the population now stands at a slightly better 22. 22. An astounding feature of the situation is this. The eventual value of a rhino horn, by the time it's been shipped out of Africa and fashioned into a piece of tasteless costume jewellery for some rich young Yemeni to strut around and pull girls with, is thousands of US dollars. But the poacher himself, the man who goes into the park and risks his life to shoot the actual rhino, which all of this time, effort and money is going into protecting, will get about $10 or $12 or $15 for the horn. So the difference between life or death for one of the rarest and most magnificent animals in the world is actually about $12. It's easy to ask, in fact I ask this, why not simply pay the poachers more not to kill the animals? The answer, of course, is very simple. If one person offers a poacher, say, $25 not to shoot an animal, and then someone else offers him $12 to shoot it, the poacher is liable to see that he can now earn $37 from the same animal. While the horns continue to command the amount of money they do, there is always going to be an incentive for someone to go and earn that money. So the question really is this. How do you persuade a young Yemeni that a rhino horn dagger is not a symbol of your manhood, but a signal of the fact that you need such a symbol? Recently, there have been two separate, though unconfirmed, sightings of northern white rhinos in southern National Park, Sudan. But the current political situation there means that very little can be done about them, and effectively, the only animals with any chance of survival have been restricted to Garamba since the 1980s. They are still in a precarious position, but there is one ray of hope. Experience with the southern white rhino. Northern white rhinos and southern white rhinos belong to the same species, but their populations have been separated for such a long time that they have evolved a range of ecological and behavioural differences. More importantly, the genetic differences are so great that scientists consider them to be separate subspecies and consequently believe that they have lived apart for more than 2 million years. Nowadays, they are permanently separated by 1,000 miles of African rainforest, woodland, and savanna. Without experience, the two animals are virtually impossible to tell apart, though the northern generally holds its head slightly higher than its southern counterpart, and their body proportions are also rather different. At the time of its discovery, the northern white was by far the commoner of the two. The southern white had been discovered nearly a century earlier, but by 1882 it was considered to be extinct. Then, at the turn of the century, a small population of about 11 animals was discovered in Umfolozi, Zululand. All the stops were pulled out to save them from extinction, and by the mid-60s, their number had increased to about 500. It was enough to begin translocating animals to other parks and reserves, and to other countries. There are now more than 5,000 southern rhinos throughout southern Africa, and they are out of immediate danger. The point is that we are not too late to save the northern white rhino from extinction. As the sun began to go down, we went and sat by the local hippos. At a wide bend in the river, the water formed a deep, slow-moving pool, and lying in the pool, grunting and bellowing, were about 200 hippopotamuses. The opposite bank was very high, so that the pool formed a sort of natural amphitheatre for the hippos to sing in. And the sound reverberated around us with such startling clarity that I don't suppose there can be a better place in the whole of Africa for hearing a hippo grunt. The light was becoming magically warm and long, and I sat watching them for an hour, aglow with amazement. The hippos nearest to us watched with a kind of uncomprehending belligerence, such as we had become used to at the airports in Zaire, but most of them simply lay there with their heads up on their neighbours' rumps, wearing huge grins of oafish contentment. I expect I was wearing something similar myself. Mark said that he had never seen anything like it in all his travels in Africa. Garamba, he said, was unique for the freedom it allowed you to get close to the animals and away from other people. There is, of course, another side to this. We heard recently that a few weeks later, someone sitting in the exact same spot where we were sitting had been attacked and killed by a lion. That night, as I turned in for the night, I discovered something very interesting. When I had first checked into my hut the day before, I had noticed that the mosquito net above the bed was tied up into a huge knot. I say noticed in the loosest possible sense of the word. It was tied up in a knot, and when I went to bed that night, I had had to untie it to drape it over the bed. Further than that, I had paid no attention to it whatsoever. Tonight, I discovered why it is that mosquito nets get tied up into knots. The reason is embarrassingly simple, and I can hardly bear to admit what it is. It's to stop the mosquitoes getting into it. I climbed into bed and gradually realized that there were almost as many mosquitoes inside the net as outside. The action of draping the net over myself was almost as much use as the magnificent fence which the Australians built across the whole of their continent to keep the rabbits out when there were already rabbits on both sides of the fence. Nervously, I shone my torch up into the dome of the net. It was black with mozzies. I tried to brush them out, and lost a few of them. I unhooked the net from the ceiling and flapped it vigorously round the room. That woke them up and got them interested. I turned the thing completely inside out, took it outside, and flapped it about a lot more, so it seemed that I'd got rid of most of them. Took it back into the room, hung it up, and climbed into bed. Almost immediately, I was being bitten crazy. I shone my torch up into the dome. It was still black with mozzies. I took the net down again, laid it out on the floor, and tried to scrape the mosquitoes off with the edge of my portable computer, which the batteries had fallen out of, thus making it useful for little else. Didn't work. I tried it again with the edge of my writing pad. That was a bit more effective, but it meant that I was trying to write between dozens of smeared mosquito corpses for the next few days. I hung the net up again and went to bed. It was still full of mosquitoes, all of which were now in a vigorous biting mood. They buzzed and zizzed around me in an excited rage. Right. I took the net down, I laid it on the floor, and I jumped on it. I continued jumping on it for a good 10 minutes, till I was certain that every square centimetre of the thing had been jumped on at least 6 times, and then I jumped on it some more. Then I found a book and smacked it with the book all over. Then I jumped on it some more, smacked it with the book again, took it outside, shook it out, took it back in, hung it up, and climbed into bed underneath it. The net was full of very angry mosquitoes. It was by now about 4 in the morning, and by the time Mark came to wake me at about 6 to go looking for rhinoceroses, I was in no mood for wildlife, and said so. He laughed in his cheery kind of way and offered me half of a tinned sausage for breakfast. I took that and a mug of powdered coffee and walked down to the river bank, which was about 50 yards away. I stood ankle-deep in the cool, quietly flowing water, listening to the early morning sounds of the birds and insects, and biting the sausage. And after a while began to be revived by the dawning realization of how absurd I must look. Charles arrived in the Land Rover, along with Annette Lanchard, and we piled our stuff for the day into it and set off. As we bumped and rattled our way out into the savannah once more, deep into the area where we had seen the rhino the previous day from the plane, I asked in a very casual, matter-of-fact, just out of interest kind of way, whether or not rhino were actually dangerous. Mark grinned and shook his head. He said we'd be very unlucky indeed to be hurt by a rhino. This didn't seem to me entirely to answer the question, but I didn't like to press the point. I was only asking out of mild curiosity. Mark went on, anyway. You hear a lot of stuff that simply isn't true, he said, or at least is blown up out of all proportion just because it sounds dramatic. It really irritates me when people pretend that animals they meet are dangerous, just so it makes them seem brave or intrepid. It's like fishermen's tales. A lot of early explorers are really terrible exaggerators. They would double or quadruple the length of the snakes they saw. Perfectly innocent anacondas became 60-foot monsters that lay in wait to crush people to death. All complete rubbish. But the anaconda's reputation has been damaged for good. But rhinos are perfectly safe, I asked. Oh, more or less. I'd be a bit wary of black rhinos if I was on foot. They've got a reputation for unprovoked aggression, which I suppose they've pretty much earned themselves. One black rhino in Kenya caught me off guard once and severely dented a friend's car, which I'd borrowed for the day. He'd only had it a few weeks. His previous car, which I'd borrowed for the weekend, been written off by a buffalo. It was all very embarrassing. Hello, we found something. Charles had brought the Land Rover to a halt and was peering at the horizon through his binoculars. Okay, he said, I think I can see one about 2 miles away. We each looked through our own binoculars, following his directions. The early morning air was still cool and there was no heat haze frying the horizon. Once I had worked out which group of trees in front of a tussocky hill it was we were meant to be looking just to the left and slightly in front of, I eventually found myself looking at something that looked suspiciously like the termite hill we'd almost killed ourselves tracking down 2 days earlier. It was very still. "Sure it's a rhino?" I asked politely. "Yep," said Charles, "dead sure. We'll stay parked here. They have very keen hearing, and the noise of the Land Rover would send it away if we drove any closer. So we walk." We gathered our cameras together and walked. "Quietly," said Charles. We walked more quietly. It was difficult to be that quiet, struggling through a wide, marsh-filled gully with our boots and even our knees farting and belching in the mud. Mark entertained us by whispering interesting facts to us. "Did you know," he said, "that bilharzia is the second most common disease in the world after tooth decay?" "No, really?" I said. "Very interesting," said Mark. "It's a disease you get from wading through infected water. Tiny snails breed in the water, and they act as hosts to tiny parasitic worms that latch onto your skin. When the water evaporates, they burrow in and attack your bladder and intestines. You'll know if you've got it, because it's like really bad flu with diarrhea, and you also piss blood." "I think we're meant to be keeping quiet," I said. Once we were on the other side of the gully, we regrouped again behind some trees, and Charles checked on the wind direction and gave us some further instructions. "You need to know something about the way that a rhino sees his world before we go barging into it," he whispered to us. "They're pretty mild and inoffensive creatures, for all their size and horns and everything. His eyesight is very poor, and he only relies on it for pretty basic information. If he sees five animals like us approaching him, he'll get nervous and run off. So we have to keep close together in single file. Then he'll think we're just one animal, and he'll be less worried." "Pretty big animal," I said. "That doesn't matter. He's not worried of big animals, but numbers bother him. We also have to stay downwind of him, which means that from here, we're going to have to make a wide circle around him. His sense of smell is very acute indeed. In fact, it's his most important sense. His whole world picture is made up of smells. He sees and smells. His nasal passages are, in fact, bigger than his brain." From here, it was at last possible to discern the creature with the naked eye. We were a bit more than half a mile from it. It was standing out in the open, looking at moments, when it was completely still, like a large outcrop of rock. From time to time, its long, sloping head would wave gently from side to side, and its horns would bob slightly up and down as, mildly and inoffensively, it cropped the grass. It was not a termite hill. We set off again very quietly, constantly stopping, ducking, and shifting our position to try and stay downwind of the creature, while the wind, which didn't care one way or the other, constantly shifted its position too. At last we made it to another small clump of trees about 100 yards from the creature, which so far had seemed to be undisturbed by our approach. From here, though, it was just open ground between us and it. We stayed here for a few minutes to watch and photograph it. If any closer approach did in fact scare it off, then this was our last opportunity. The animal was turned slightly away from us, continuing gently to crop the grass. At last the wind was well established in our favour, and nervously, quietly, we set off again. It was a little like that game we play as children, in which one child stands facing the wall, while the others try to creep up behind and touch her. She will, from time to time, suddenly turn round, and anyone she catches moving has to go all the way to the back and start again. Generally, she won't be in a position to impale anyone she doesn't like the look of on a 3-foot horn, but in other respects, it was similar. The animal is, of course, a herbivore. It lives by grazing. The closer we crept to it, and the more monstrously it loomed in front of us, the more incongruous its gentle activity seemed to be. It was like watching a JCB excavator quietly getting on with a little weeding. At about 40 yards distance, the rhinoceros suddenly stopped eating and looked up. It turned slowly to look at us, and regarded us with grave suspicion, while we tried very hard to look like the smallest and most inoffensive animal we could possibly be. It watched us carefully, but without apparent comprehension, its small black eyes peering dully at us from either side of its horn. You can't help but try and follow an animal's thought processes, and you can't help, when faced with an animal like a 3-ton rhinoceros with nasal passages bigger than its brain, but fail. The world of smells is now virtually closed to modern man. Not that we haven't got a sense of smell. We sniff our food or wine, we occasionally smell a flower, and we can usually tell if there's a gas leak. But generally, it's all a bit of a blur, and often an irrelevant or bothersome blur at that. When we read that Napoleon wrote to Josephine on one occasion, "Don't wash, I'm coming home," we are simply bemused and almost think of it as deviant behaviour. We are so used to thinking of sight, closely followed by hearing, as the chief of the senses, that we find it hard to visualise, the word itself is a giveaway, a world which declares itself primarily to the sense of smells. It's not a world our mental processes can resolve, or at least they are no longer practised in resolving it. For a great many animals, however, smell is the chief of the senses. It tells them what is good to eat and what is not. We go by what the packet tells us in the sell-by date. It guides them towards food that isn't within line of sight. We already know where the shops are. It works at night. We turn on the light. It tells them of the presence and state of mind of other animals. We use language. It also tells them what other animals have been in the vicinity and doing what in the last day or two. We simply don't know unless they've left a note. Rhinoceroses declare their movements and their territory to other animals by stamping in their feces and then leaving smell traces of themselves wherever they walk, which is the sort of note we would not appreciate being left. When we smell something slightly unexpected, if we can't immediately make sense of it and it isn't particularly bothersome, we simply ignore it, and this is probably equivalent to the rhino's reaction to seeing us. It appeared not to make any particular decision about us, but merely to forget that it had a decision to make. The grass presented it with something infinitely richer and more interesting to its senses, and the animal returned to cropping it. We crept on closer. Eventually we got to within about 25 yards, and Charles signalled us to stop. We were close enough, quite close enough. We were, in fact, astoundingly close to it. The animal measured about 6 feet high at its shoulders and sloped down gradually towards its hindquarters and its rear legs, which were chubby with muscle. The sheer immensity of every part of it exercised a fearful magnetism on the mind. When the rhino moved a leg just slightly, huge muscles moved easily under its skin, like Volkswagens parking. The noise of our cameras seemed to distract it, and it looked up again, but not in our direction. It appeared not to know what to think about this, and after a while returned to grazing. The light breeze that was blowing towards us began to shift its direction, and we shifted with it, which brought us round more to the front of the rhino. This seemed to us, in our world dominated by vision, to be an odd thing to do, but so long as the rhino could not smell us, it could take or leave what we looked like. It then turned slightly towards us itself, so that we were suddenly crouched in full view of the beast. It seemed to chew a little more thoughtfully, but for a while paid us no more mind than that. We watched quietly for fully 3 or 4 minutes, and even the sound of our cameras ceased to bother the animal. After a few minutes, we became a little more careless about noise and started to talk to each other about our reactions, and now the rhino became a little more restive and uneasy. It stopped grazing, lifted its head and looked at us steadily for about a minute, still uncertain what to do. Again, I imagine myself sort of sitting here in my study writing this through the afternoon and gradually realizing that a slight smell I had noticed earlier is still there, and beginning to wonder if I should start to look for other clues as to what it could be. I would start to look for something I could see, a bottle of something that's fallen over or something electrical that's overheating. The smell is simply the clue that there's something I should look for. For the rhino, the sight of us was simply a clue that there was something he should sniff for. And he began to sniff the air more carefully and to move around in a slow, careful arc. At that moment, the wind began to move around and gave us away completely. The rhino snapped to attention, turned away from us, and hurtled off across the plain like a nimble young tank. We had seen our northern white rhinoceros, and it was time to go home. The next day, Charles flew us back across the ostrich skin savanna to Bunia Airport, where we were due once more to pick up a missionary flight returning to Nairobi. The plane was already there waiting, and a representative from the airline assured us, against the evidence of all our previous experience, that there would be no problems. We could go straight to the plane. Then, a few minutes later, we were told we would just have to go quickly to the immigration office. We could leave our bags. We went to the immigration office, where we were told that we should bring our bags. We brought our bags. Expensive-looking camera equipment. We were then confronted by a large Zayawa official in a natty blue suit, whom we had noticed earlier hanging around watching us take our baggage out of Charles's plane. I had had the feeling then that he was sizing us up for something. He examined our passports for a goodish long time before acknowledging our presence at all. Then at last he looked up at us, and a wide smile crept slowly across his face. "You entered the country," he said, "at Bukavu?" In fact, he said it in French, so we made a bit of a meal of understanding him, which was something that experience had taught us to do. Eventually, we admitted that, insofar as we'd understood the question, yes, we had entered at Bukavu. "Then," he said, quietly, triumphantly, "you must leave from Bukavu." He made no move to give us back our passports. We looked at him blankly. He explained slowly. "Tourists," he said, "had to leave the country from the same port by which they had entered." Smile. We utterly failed to understand what he had said. This was almost true anyway. It was the most preposterous invention. He still held on to our passports. Next to him, a young girl was sitting, studiously copying down copious information from other visitors' passports, information that would almost certainly never see the light of day again. We stood and argued while our plane sat out on the tarmac waiting to take off to Nairobi. But the official simply sat and held our passports. We knew it was nonsense. He knew we knew it was nonsense. That was clearly part of the pleasure of it. He smiled at us again, gave us a slow, contented shrug, and idly brushed a bit of fluff off the sleeve of the natty blue suit, towards the cost of which he clearly expected a major contribution. On the wall above him, gazing seriously into the middle distance, from a battered frame, stood the figure of President Mobutu, resplendent in his leopard-skin pillbox hat.